Welcome to this mini-series of episodes that explores stories, ideas, and parts of history that you may never knew existed, but that hold some interesting and inspirational knowledge-building take-home messages. This week, we aim to gain some understanding of survivorship bias. And as the name of the podcast suggests, I myself am a very curious being. I absolutely love exploring ideas and theories based on social psychology and reading books on critical thinking and lightly skimming some deep and dark philosophical trains of thought, which actually, as I say that, that's actually quite a good idea. This is essentially what it is. This podcast is a train of thought. But I guess, unlike a regular train with a predetermined destination, I have absolutely no idea where this will lead. But isn't that all part of the fun? So what have I been up to this week? Poetry has been in the forefront, I think. A few weeks back, I was asked to produce a spoken word poetry piece as a motivational video for a local sports team, and something I'd never done before. Now, the poetry that you might have seen on my Facebook page and across the social media and even on the podcast itself has been something of an evolutionary process for me, something I'm just really getting into, right? I don't really know much about it. And I had this opportunity presented to me where I was asked to write this piece, and I absolutely loved it. I did. I got so immersed in it. I researched it heavily. I was using ideas based upon emotional viewing with words and music and video footage, stuff that I hadn't really thought about before, because the stuff that I'd written previously was really about my perceptions of the world and experiences that were happening all around me. And that was easier, I feel, to write out because, you know, I felt it. I was part of it. This was something that was essentially existential to me. I had to try and connect with an audience that I didn't know. I had to try and write something that was going to do justice to the reason why it was being presented. And also, I guess there was a little bit of apprehension because essentially football is what I do, right? I coach football, and this was going to a football team, and would there be connections? And all of that was really playing in my head. And as much as I enjoyed it, I really did, there was a little bit of self-doubt. There was that imposter syndrome there, and that really hasn't gone away. It was kind of weird because I hadn't really thought about that in that extent previously. Now, I had discussions about imposter syndrome before, and I've done a little bit of work around some podcast episodes on one, but I've never released anything. And I guess just trying to come up with ideas for that poetry piece and to make it as, I don't know if I felt pressure. Is pressure the right word? I'm not too sure, but I guess I felt kind of way that I was trying to do this to please others, right? Anything I've written in the past, I wasn't really trying to please anybody with. It was just my own thoughts and experiences, whereas this one was being specific. And I guess the imposter syndrome did creep in, and that self-doubt did creep in. And that hasn't really, like I said, left. And even when I've been coaching the last week and been in a few games, I know that the decisions that I have to make, I'm confident in those in my head. It's just, can I go and put them into practice? Do I trust myself that much that these thoughts and feelings I'm having about that self-doubt, how do I get them out of the way? So it's been a crazy week in that respect. And I guess I've actually written a few notes about doing another episode of this mini series on imposter syndrome, and I think I will do that. I think I'll put my notes into audio form to do that. So that's kind of where my week's been. It's been in that poetry sense. It's been the spoken word stuff. It's been kind of fighting with this idea of imposter syndrome and trying to understand it, trying to get my head around what it really is, and all of that combined. Then it kind of disappeared a little bit over the weekend, out for a few drinks, as you do, and it came back. And when we were back on the pitch, and recording this on a Thursday, that was last night, and a Wednesday night, and so it's just that kind of weird kind of exploration, this trying to understand the psychology behind it, trying to read up on the theories behind it, what are the trigger points, and so that's how deep I got with it, or how deep I am getting with it. But I guess that's this week, so let's focus on the actual podcast episode itself. So put simply, what is survivorship bias? Well, survivorship bias, it's our tendency to misunderstand what success really looks like because we completely disregard the failures. Now, take, for example, James Dyson. We've all heard the Dyson Hoover, right? That man had an almighty amount of failures before he invented what is now a revolutionary vacuum cleaner, right? it's something that you see, or I did when I was growing up anyway, on the TV and going, you know, I didn't really know who he was or didn't know what Dyson vacuums were, but you could see it everywhere. They were on the TV, they're in the Argos catalogs. But the amount of failures that man had beforehand was sensational. I read a book once, and I think in the book they quoted something like over 1,200 failures of prototypes before he actually got the prototype that worked or he was comfortable with and he liked. And but yet we look at him as he's some kind of genius inventor, that he, you know, he's up there with the gods of invention, but we completely disregard all of the failures that he went through to get to the final product. And I mean, if you take another example, one who was in the news there recently, Richard Branson, who has more money, by the way, than anyone will ever need. If you do a quick Google search of the list of companies that he owns and the amount of money that he has, whether that's personal wealth or whether that's wrapped up in assets, who's to know? But at the minute, he's charging in excess of £250,000 for a seat on his next space flight. And obviously, he went to space then a few weeks back. But I mean, that's besides the point. Branson had loads of failed businesses before Virgin took off, and no pun intended with that one. His Virgin Media company, for example, was born out of a failed student magazine business. His Virgin Airlines company nearly crashed, quite literally, because during the initial test flight, one of Virgin's only planes was a rented Boeing 747. And as it was flying, a flock of birds flew into its engine. It caused huge damage. The airline couldn't get certified to start carrying passengers without a working plane, and it couldn't get money for repairs without being certified. So here's this idea of creating this brand new airline that was going to change the way that people flew. If you remember the old adverts that were on TV of the Splendor walking in the airport, as you've seen the air hostesses walk into the airplane, and all of the business lounge classes and all of those videos that you've seen at the time, it made it look really grand and opulent. And I remember actually going through the airport once, it was in Heathrow, I was getting a connecting flight to America, and I seen the Virgin Atlantic Business Lounge. And I walked past, and just as I got maybe, I don't know, three quarters of the way up, I turned around and looked to my right, and it was just marble. It was beautiful. I can only imagine what it looked like inside and what you got inside. But that's the kind of picture he was trying to portray, that he wanted to change the way that the passenger flights would be, and that this is what Virgin Airlines was supposed to be. But it didn't work, right? Because of the very first time he tried to do it, it crashed, and flock of birds into the engine, so he had to rethink how he ran that. And that's probably one of his most successful businesses. But even before that, in 1994, he created Virgin Cola, and his aim was completely, I mean, for any, if you want to call sane person a rational person, he wanted to take on Coca-Cola. I mean, they are the best known, they're the biggest in the world. I mean, Pepsi Max, I know, is out there, but for me, Pepsi Max is kind of like a little brother to Coca-Cola, right? It's never going to be as big. But that was his aim. He wanted to create this cola to take on Coca-Cola. And he actually was quoted as saying that Coke is the best known brand in the world, and if we could topple Coke, we thought that would be a lot of fun. So I don't know whether he was had a few spare 100 million lying about and wanted to create an extra soda that wants to go and challenge Coke, and he thought that would be a great idea, but it didn't work, right? Then there's the failed attempt to travel around the world the first time in a hot air balloon, which literally almost killed him when it crashed. And then there was Virgin Cars in the early 2000s, which aimed to change the way people bought cars online. That company also failed and was shut down. Then there was Virgin Digital Media, which failed to get almost any downloads when it first launched, and I think it was 2005. So there was loads of those businesses either in the background or whilst he was building his most successful, which would be Virgin Atlantic Airlines, and is obviously now Virgin Media is big and it's getting to the broadband and things. But before all of that, or whilst that was going, there were failures as well. But why do we as society then, like James Dyson, do we focus on just that one success when there's so much wealth and so much knowledge to be gained from looking into the failures and using those as ways in which that we can either increase our own successes in life, and looking back on our own failures and reflecting and thinking what could go next. And how often do people ask, or do you see celebrities on TV, for example, or hear them on podcasts or radio stations, and they're talking about their greatest achievement? I mean, you see it on those talk shows all of the time, and the talk show host never talks about what is the one failure that helped inspire you to that success, because that's not, they don't want to see that. That's not glamoury. That doesn't make headlines, does it, right? they want just the good stuff, the sparkly stuff, the stuff that is successful. And I believe there's more to it. I believe there's more wealth that can be drawn from understanding failures. And that is essentially where I want to try and take this episode.
I'm going here, I'm going. I'm gonna crash, Mayday, Mayday, Mayday.
1511 say altitude. Rolling, I'm rolling, I'm rolling, I'm rolling. Oh my God! I'm... During the midst of the Second World War, America had a problem. How to make its fleet of aircraft bulletproof? More precisely, why was it losing so many of its stunning array of fighter jets to enemy fire? An arsenal that included some of the world's greatest fighter jets, the Curtiss P-40 Warhawk, the Lockheed P-38 Lightning, the Grumman F-6F Hellcat, and what many consider to be the jewel of the aviation wartime crown, the North American P-51 Mustang. The Mustang had an incredible range of 950 miles. But if you add to that external tanks, we're talking a range of 2,200 miles. This aircraft was both fast and manoeuvrable. The P-51D Mustang could reach a top speed of 437 miles an hour, and if that wasn't enough, it carried amongst its weaponry 6.50 caliber machine guns. This was the kind of fighter jet that all airmen wish they would fly. But let's face it, if the country struggles to keep its most revered weapon in flight, it has little chance of winning anything, never mind nullifying the threat of Nazi Germany. Perhaps no one man had a greater influence over the development and adaptation of the P-51 Mustang than the visionary Lieutenant Colonel Thomas J. Hitchcock Jr. At 17, Hitchcock began his military career during World War I with the French Lafayette Flying Corps after being turned away by the US Army for being too young. Earning his wings with the French, Hitchcock scored 3 aerial victories before the Germans shot him down and captured him. After being held captive for 6 months, Hitchcock saw a chance to escape. He jumped from a moving train and walked more than 100 miles to safety in Switzerland. His many close friends included the writer F. Scott Fitzgerald, who loosely modelled his character Tom Buchanan in The Great Gatsby on Hitchcock. When the United States entered World War II, Hitchcock secured a commission in the US Army Air Force and desperately sought for command of a fighter squadron. And at 42, however, the US Army Air Force considered him far too old for combat. But that didn't stop him. After his appointment as Assistant Military Air Attache in London, Hitchcock reported to Washington on the results of the British tests involving the North American-built P-51A airframe and the Rolls-Royce Merlin 61 engine. In 1942, Rolls-Royce test pilot Ron Hawker evaluated the Mustang, powered by the stock Allison engine, and was impressed by the aircraft's performance at low and medium altitudes. But Hawker thought performance at high altitudes could be vastly improved by installing the Merlin 61 engine. The British fitted 5 test aircraft with the Merlin engine, and the results were nothing short of astounding. Hawker's assessment proved correct. The Merlin engine-powered Mustangs reached speeds in excess of 430 miles an hour at 30,000 feet, almost 100 miles an hour faster than the Allison engine. Now, by early 1944, the Mustang's arrival, along with new aggressive tactics, was beginning to change the tide of air war in the Allies' favour. During Big Week, a week-long bombing offence in February 1944 that targeted German fighter aircraft production facilities, Mustang pilots destroyed 17% of the Luftwaffe's experienced fighter pilots in air-to-air combat. Now shepherding the Mustang project as Deputy Chief of Staff of the 9th Air Support Command in charge of tactical research and development, Hitchcock insisted on pinpointing the problem himself, rather than risking the lives of his men. He was unable to pull his Mustang out of a dive during a test flight on April 18, 1944, and died in the subsequent crash near Salisbury, in England. Hitchcock did not live to see how the P-51 Mustang contributed to the Allied air supremacy, which was a prerequisite for the successful invasion of Normandy just 2 months later. But by March 1944, with Mustangs escorting the first US daylight bombing raids on Berlin in the skies over the Nazi capital, Hitchcock saw the fighter he had championed achieve the potential that he had once envisioned way back in 1942. Now, before we continue, allow me to digress somewhat. Back in the 1930s, Dr. Joseph Rhine set out to test whether or not extrasensory perception really existed. Now, in layman's terms, that's what we might describe as a sixth sense. And I know what you're thinking, and trust me, when I put this podcast together, I never envisaged I'd be talking about paranormal psychology. Before we can continue, let's dive into exactly what ESP is. And here's an extract from a video produced by Adam Walsden on YouTube that takes us on a somewhat psychedelic journey into the early years of ESP research.
Today, a young man on acid realized that all matter is merely energy condensed to a slow vibration, that we are all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. There is no such thing as death. Life is only a dream, and we are the imagination of ourselves.
If we can just focus on what we want to achieve and go with the intent, the most powerful thing we can do, what's our intent, what's our focus? This is what I want to do with my life. That intent goes out as a vibrational frequency, and it will always bring towards us experiences and challenges that lead us to achieve what we want to achieve.
Extrasensory perception is defined as the ability to acquire information by paranormal means, independent of any known physical senses or deduction from previous experience. The term was coined by Duke University researcher J.B. Rhine to denote psychic abilities such as telepathy, precognition, and clairvoyance. In the 1930s at Duke University, J.B. Rhine and his wife Louisa tried to develop physical research into an experimental science. They named it parapsychology. While Louisa Rhine concentrated on collecting accounts of spontaneous cases, J.B. Rhine worked largely in the laboratory, carefully defining terms such as ESP and designing experiments to test them. A simple set of cards was developed, originally called Zener cards. They bear the symbols circle, square, wavy lines, cross, and star. In a telepathy experiment, the sender looks at a series of cards while the receiver guesses the symbols. To try to observe clairvoyance, the pack of cards is hidden from everyone while the receiver guesses. In all such experiments, the order of the cards must be random so that hits are not obtained through systematic biases. An advantage of ESP cards is that the statistics can easily be applied to determine whether the number of hits obtained is higher than would be expected by chance. Rhine used ordinary people as subjects and claimed that on average they did significantly better than chance expectation. Through these years, 50 studies were published. 33 were contributed by investigators other than Rhine and the Duke University group. 61% of these independent studies reported significant results suggestive of ESP.
Okay, I have to admit, maybe giving you that information on psychedelic research and psychological input to paranormal activity is a little bit too much for an episode on survivor bias, but let's just think about it for a second. As interesting as the experiment is, it was a case of survivor bias. The experiment unintentionally found the probability that someone, anyone in the participant pool would guess correctly each time. It didn't determine that a particular person had abilities. You see, that's exactly what survivorship bias is. It's a common logical error that distorts our understanding of the world. It happens when we assume that success tells the whole story, and when we don't adequately consider past failures. Now, not to sound too negative, but in some cases, it has more to do with luck than anything that you've learned along the way. I think now it's probably a good time to get back to World War II and meet the next star of our show. We pick up the story as US military leaders turn to the son of a Hungarian beggar, educated at home by his elder brother, to to help fortify their aerial battles with the Luftwaffe. Step forward, Abraham Wald. Early in his childhood, he developed a love for mathematics, and at the age of 14, he left home to study at the University of Vienna. But when Wald's studies were completed, it was the mid-1930s and Austria was deep in economic distress, and there was no possibility that a foreigner could be hired as a professor in Vienna. Wald was rescued by a job offer from Oscar Morgenstern. Morgenstern would then later emigrate to the US and help invent game theory, but in 1933, he was the director of the Austrian Institute for Economic Research, and he hired Wald at a small salary to do some odd mathematical jobs. That turned out to be a very good move for Wald. His experience in economics got him a fellowship offer from Carl's Commission, an economic institute then located in Colorado Springs. Despite the ever-worsening political situation, Wald was reluctant to take the step that would lead him away from pure mathematics for good. But then the Nazis conquered Austria, making Wald's decision substantially easier. After just a few months in Colorado, he was offered a professorship of statistics at Columbia. He packed up once again and moved to New York. And that was where he fought the war. Wald would later find himself working out of a fourth floor apartment a few streets away from the center of Harlem, as part of a group called the Applied Mathematics Panel. The panel were a group of brilliant mathematicians. Working on behalf of the military, they were given the job of analysing a whole range of issues, such as the most effective pattern of torpedo launching. Let's take a moment to listen to how author David McRaney describes Wald's time in Harlem.
It starts in 1941 in an apartment complex in New York City, overlooking Morningside Heights, and this is what it looks like today, but it hasn't changed very much since then. Only the cars really have changed. And at the time, people walking around on the street, they couldn't have known that four stories above them, a group of mathematical soldiers were engaged in statistical combat, daily creating equations that would both snuff and spare several hundred thousand human lives. And the reason for that was because it was war. And war had become more complicated than any one person could ever hope to understand. So many things had just been introduced into the world that were now on the battlefield right away. Things like rockets and radar and sonar and submarines and tank divisions and long-range bomber squadrons. Things that had just been unveiled at the World's Fair were now cracking that world apart. So no commander could be expected to really absorb the battlefield. And it's obvious to modern minds what these people needed were computers. But a computer in 1941 was a clunky experiment made out of telephone switches and vacuum tubes, and there weren't very many of them. And you might think, well, they could have used calculators, but a calculator in 1941 was sort of a hybrid mix of a typewriter and a cash register, so that's not going to work either. What is great, though, is that they did have all of the computers they would ever need. It's just that in 1941, the world's most powerful number crunchers ran on toast and coffee. And the Applied Mathematics Panel's job was to sort of serve as like a military-based tech support. So what would happen is that a commander in the field would have this problem, couldn't solve it. They would call up the Applied Mathematics Panel and say, hey, can you get me a scientist who can work this out? And then the scientist would work out something that no one had ever figured out before. And advancing that field that they worked in, they would later win a Nobel Prize in an effort to advance this combat in a way that would maybe win a war for global control of the planet. So very similar to calling tech support. And the things they worked on, you know about the things they worked on. You've heard of some of these things, code breaking, the atomic bomb, that sort of thing. But one problem they worked on most of all as the war progressed was aircraft survivability. Aircraft survivability is basically trying to make sure that your planes make it home more often than not and the enemy's planes don't. And this was a really pressing problem as the war went on because the chances of a single bomber crew member making it from the beginning of the war to the end of the war was, at the height of the war, basically a coin flip. It was 50-50. So if you could improve the odds of these people by just 1%, maybe 2%, then you could really affect the outcome of the war.
Wald's involvement, which only came to light years later, was perhaps the most astonishing intervention of all. He was asked by the military to help them with a crucial issue. Bomber aircraft in Europe were being asked to take huge risks. Kevin Wilson, the military historian, described these remarkable and brave men as ghosts already. The wartime leaders realized that they needed to reinforce the planes with armor. This would help protect them from gunfire from the ground and from the air. The problem is that they could not armor the entire surface area because the planes would become too heavy to fly and lose maneuverability. Wald was brought in to prioritize the areas that needed armor the most. The military command came up with what seemed like the perfect plan. They would place armor on the areas of the planes where there were holes. This is where the bullets were impacting and therefore where the planes needed additional protection. It was plain common sense. To those in positions of military leadership, it was the best way to shield their brave airmen from enemy fire. But Wald, he disagreed. He realized that the chiefs had neglected to take into account some very key data. They were only considering the planes that had returned. They were not taking into account the planes that had not returned, the planes that had been shot down. The observable bullet holes suggested that the area around the cockpit and tail did not need reinforcing because it was never hit. In fact, the planes that were hit in these places were crashing because this is where they were most vulnerable. In effect, the holes in the returning aircraft represented areas where a bomber could take damage and still return home safely. They had survived precisely because they had not been hit in the cockpit or tail. The pattern of holes, far from indicating where the armor needed to be added to the aircraft, was actually revealing the areas where it did not. The insight turned out to be of profound importance, not just to the bomber command, but to the entire war effort. Wald's analysis of bullet-riddled aircraft in the Second World War saved lives of dozens of airmen. His seminal paper for the military was not declassified until July 1980, but you can find it today via a simple search on Google. It's titled, A Method of Estimating Plane Vulnerability Based on Damage of Survivors. It wasn't until after the war that Wald learned of the murder of 8 of his 9 family members at the hands of the Nazis. And according to those who knew him best, the pain of loss never left him. One of his close friends wrote, "Even this cruel blow failed to make him embittered, although a certain sadness could be felt to be with him for the rest of his life." Simply put, survivorship bias is your tendency to focus on survivors instead of whatever you call a non-survivor depending on the situation. Sometimes that means you tend to focus on the living instead of the dead, or on the winners instead of the losers, or on the success instead of the failures. In Wald's problem, the military focused on the planes that made it home and almost made a terrible decision because they ignored the ones that got shot down. It is easy to do. After any process that leaves behind survivors, the non-survivors are often destroyed or muted or removed from your view. If failures become invisible, then naturally you will pay more attention to successes. Not only do you fail to recognize what is missing that might hold such important information, you fail to recognize that there is any missing information at all.